You're listening to a podcast by BI Norwegian Business School.
Welcome to the new season of Stay Ahead, a podcast from BI Norwegian Business School. This season, we're exploring entrepreneurship, going beyond the startup. I'm your host, Susanna Pinnick. I'm a former entrepreneur, and I'm currently doing a PhD in entrepreneurship here at BI. In this series, we're talking to experts, entrepreneurs, and academics about some key topics in entrepreneurship. And today, our topic is AI, artificial intelligence. It seems to be everywhere at the moment. We hear about its huge promise or its great threat, often in the same time. Today, we plan to look at AI from the perspective of the entrepreneur and the investor, among others. And my guests today are Alan Said and Ed Saidi. Alan works in cyber threat intelligence at Defendable and has many years of experience in cybersecurity, machine learning, and artificial intelligence. He's also an associate professor here at BI, focusing on cybersecurity and machine learning. Ed, too, is an associate professor here at BI, and he teaches machine learning and innovation strategy, with research being on strategy and finance aspects of entrepreneurship and innovation. Related to AI, he's recently been exploring how the recruitment of AI talent from universities to industry is affecting the innovativeness of firms. So welcome to you both. Thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Thanks, Susanna.
Thank you very much.
Alan, can I start by asking you about AI and try and, you know, kind of debunk some of the myths? What do you see as the key aspects of AI as a new technology to most of us?
Machine learning or AI, artificial intelligence. Let me rephrase that sentence by saying it really depends who you ask. Mm-hmm. If you ask the machine learning practitioners, or those who are really involved in building machine learning models and artificial intelligence, they see AI as a tool to facilitate and simplify your daily work. We don't really see it as a replacement. We see it as a tool that complements your daily work. Mm-hmm. And that could be in finance and cybersecurity, in medical sector, private sector, whatever you really think about it.
Mm-hmm. And how is that differentiated from AI? Or is it just interchangeable terms, machine learning and AI? Is there a distinction?
We could say that machine learning is a subset of artificial intelligence, mm-hmm. where we use data as a backbone in order to predict or identify or classify a certain pattern.
Oh, I see. Okay. So... they're not interchangeable. One is a subset of the other.
If we're
talking about AI, we'll always have an element of machine learning?
Yes.
Right. Okay. You mentioned cybersecurity as being a use for AI. So how are you guys using AI in cybersecurity?
So in the context of cybersecurity, we can use machine learning or artificial intelligence to detect various different attacks. This is where we use classification and unsupervised learning algorithms. We can also use machine learning in the context of forensics as well, when we identify, when there is an attack, and in the context of incident response, once we get the data, and the data is relatively huge, we could use machine learning models to identify a specific pattern which can be useful in the court of law. In the context of cyber attack, this is something is actually relatively new. The latest application around this topic is WormGPT, which is designed to generate source codes of malware or can be used for a phishing campaign. We don't really have any evidence at the moment that the existing attacks are generated from WormGPT or anything like that, any attacks that is generated using artificial intelligence. But we do have proof of concept, mm-hmm. that prove this approach to be correct.
Okay, so it's possible.
It is possible,
And that kind of underpins that a lot of this stuff is new and evolving. And so, Ed, I'm going to turn to you and say, you know, when it comes to developing tools that use AI or new businesses that use AI or based on AI, where are we seeing the startup activity, or are we seeing it?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a huge rise in startup activity on AI. I'd say the start of this had been a number of years ago, going back to 2016 or so. There were in Silicon Valley many startups that started trying to use AI in different ways. I think really cloud computing probably kickstarted that, where it became a lot cheaper for startups to experiment with data, experiment with what you're capable of getting out of from data. And that's cloud computing really opening up cheap computational power to startups, so removing the fixed costs for them to invest in the servers you needed to run the best models. So now, even though that was the case and there was a lot of startup activity, say, in Silicon Valley earlier, it's nowhere near what we see now in around generative AI that's happened since the release of ChatGPT. Mm-hmm. And I call that release of ChatGPT sort of the eureka moment for the for the masses of basically what AI, NLP, natural language processing in particular, is able to do for us. And, you know, there's a plethora of startups that have basically been working on developing their business around generative AI right now. Mm-hmm. So even though total investments have gone down within the space of the startups sphere around the world since the peak in 2021, AI is a standout area where there's more and more money flowing into helping startups grow their businesses. But now, that being said, you know, most of the work in developing AI has been happening in major companies, mm-hmm. and large companies. Now, that's the Microsofts and Googles and the Facebooks, so the FANGs, as well as, say, very well-funded new firms like OpenAI, or Anthropic now as an example, that have been getting billions and billions of dollars of funding to build models. So the majority of work happening in AI is centered around, these large firms, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of startup activity happening around it. I should also mention that there's a lot happening within governments, within military sector, that doesn't get as much visibility as what yeah. happens in within startups and within large firms.
So presumably one of the reasons why a lot of this stuff is being done in fairly large firms is because, as Alan was saying, there's a huge amount of data, a huge amount of investment before you can even kind of start. But then at the same time, you mentioned about this eureka moment, making it sort of somewhat accessible to smaller startups.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. So there was a component of that. I think there's a part of what's been fundamental in opening access to it has been some of these large companies opening up their models for use. So there's more open models like the Facebook's Lambda model that has, where much of the code is online and you can see what's happening. Then there's other models that you can tap into their API, like OpenAI's ChatGPT, GPT-4 as well. And you can pay for access, but then build software on top of that, mm-hmm. build plugins, et cetera. So that has democratized the ability for firms to tap into these super powerful models. Now, that being said, the kicker really is that there's only a number of organizations that can afford the huge computational cost to develop these models.
I think the question for me, why would I actually build anything from scratch if I have access to those models and pay the subscriptions, really?
Yeah, absolutely.
So then that controls a lot of the, the power in the hands of a few large organizations, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And is there any kind of breaking into that? Is it just too hard? Has that become its own barrier to entry?
Well, I think something that's happening very recently, I was reading about state governments getting into training models as well. So we all know that China's government has been building really powerful models, and that's aside from, say, what Baidu or some of the largest companies, Tencent, are doing in China. But just reading recently, the UAE has been spending billions of dollars in training their own large language model, which they have spent, you know, tens of billions, and they've released a model that matches Google's best open source model, and they've developed that internally. So, and that just tells you about the ambitions of some state actors mm-hmm. in trying to make this happen. In the UAE's case, they've open sourced again the model, similar to what Facebook has done with its Lambda model. And I think that that could bring about a lot of good entrepreneurship around it. But you'd wonder what some state actors are probably doing privately as well. And not sharing.
So
openly.
For me, when I hear these things, I'm actually thinking about collecting data of individuals indirectly through the means of, for example, OpenAI. Yeah. So when we actually use ChatGPT, this is an indirect collection of your behavior because you ask a lot of questions, you ask a lot of, you know, you send a lot of queries, and these are somehow locked. And the more you do this, the more they know about your behavior. And we don't know whether this is going to be used in future or not.
Absolutely.
Particularly if you don't know which actor is behind the
exactly.
the tool that you're using.
So back in the day, it was Google where it was collecting data. Nowadays, it's a different approach.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you could...
I mean, you still get that in, you know, using Google anyway, so...
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, proprietary data gets to be really valuable as a second order to having huge computational power within
the But I think the second stage will be behavioral data.
Right.
You know, individual data. How do you think? How do you behave? How do you actually compile set of questions? And these are really important information.
Yeah. So that's really interesting because when it comes to things like GDPR, regulations designed to help us protect our privacy...
Is it really protecting?
Yeah, I was going to say, are those rules extensive enough to cover this? Are they?
I'm not too sure. No.
Yeah, and they're probably not as updated, are they, no. Alan? You know, GDPR was put together, in 2013 to 15 or so, and implemented after that. You know, we've come years down the line, and, you know, there's AI models have improved, and we've seen new ways in which, you know, some state actors collect information. Facial recognition. So I think that is, does that speak to some of the behavioral data that you're talking about?
Voice, text, and images. These are all collective data.
Yeah. And then what do you think of, I wonder what you think of the regulation aspect and does it need to be updated?
I think so at some point. I mean, we focus quite a lot on data that we willingly put into any companies in terms of, you know, your personal data. But we never talk about behavioral data, you know, data that actually describe you as a person, your personality. And when you think about ChatGPT, the more questions you ask, the more ChatGPT learns about you as a person. Unless or otherwise you use one account by 10 different people, which, you know, it will confuse the model somehow.
Yeah, and I find that ironic too that some, you know, we've created some regulation. So I was reading about how, you know, the EU mandated that whether you would accept or not that they would track you with cookies or et cetera at the bottom of each page. Now, super interestingly, certain companies like Google started actually finding perfect ways to identify you, you know, by getting around these regulations that the EU imposed on, like, not tracking which person it is. So Google started looking at all your other browsing activity in, say, Google Chrome or across their website. And some reports are that with 99% accuracy, they know who exactly you are. You know, it used to be 100%, and it's now 99%.
Or metadata.
right? And so that's the, where the regulation doesn't exactly. So use of the metadata with some of the best AI models likely. So, you know, it just goes to show, well, you know, regulation seems to have failed here.
Just maybe by being a little behind the curve.
That's right. That's right. So, and these are examples, I think, of how probably regulators shouldn't, you know, stall the progress of it, but they should be wary of constantly updating regulations.
Mm. And when it comes to the startup scene then, just thinking about the sort of smaller entrepreneurial startups who are using this as a kind of base on which to build whatever it is they're going to build and take to market, what are the challenges apart from the ones that we've talked about so far, the regulations, the amount of data and that? Are there any other specific challenges for those kinds of firms, or are their risks pretty much the same as any other entrepreneurial venture?
I think, you know, what a lot of established firms had done had been to try to use AI to improve business processes within the organization. And so that became a complement to whatever else they were doing. You know, that was the use of AI there. And one area where I think startups can play a special role is AI hasn't been used to improve creativity, enhance it in any way, you know, to really improve productivity, because I think there's a misunderstanding by the population of where the added value of it is. And I think startups that can try to help other companies get more out of AI in terms of getting more creativity of users, or help them be more reliably productive. I think we have to talk about that, what that means. But I think that's an area in which they can add a lot of value to other companies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's also a lot of missteps companies could take in implementing machine learning models and implementing AI models. You know, we talk in machine learning about, you know, target leakage, a whole lot of range of issues that you can have that will make the models way less reliable.
So I think starting a machine learning project or an artificial intelligence project, if you know, want to call it AI project, it's a risky business, in my opinion, because ML or AI is data-driven project. And we need to be sure about the quality of that data, whether the data is relevant to that problem, whether it's actually biased or whether imbalanced. You know, there are a lot of things that you need to do. And it's a risky business because you don't know whether you actually build a good predictive model at the end. You're going to use this in a law court of law. So this is where explainable AI will come into the equation. You know, a set of other algorithms at the bottom that verifies this prediction. And yet we're not too sure whether this is actually true or not, because we need to verify that. So it is a lengthy process. It requires a lot of time and a lot of data.
Mm-hmm.
And since this is data-driven, and data changes over time, you know, because data, you know, one important part of data is behavior, and behaviors are changing over time, you know. So you need to have this continuous learning process in place.
So continually training your model and retraining it and retraining it and retraining it, and then being able to explain how you're retraining it to ensure that whoever's using the most recent output is confident that it's correct, reliable.
True.
Especially if you're going to court, as you were talking about earlier on, about using it in court.
So that's why you shouldn't really replace your existing tools with an AI tool. It should be a complementary tool, you know, to facilitate and help you with your daily work.
Now, from my experience on machine learning projects, we're spending about 80% of our time on data cleaning and data, you know, gathering data, going through the legal process, of making sure it's
whether it's relevant or not as well.
You know? Right, that too. Mm. What would be, you know, you touched on some of them, Alan, but what would be some other piece of advice you'd have for project managers of a machine learning project, you know, say their founders in a company?
I would start with a very simple question. What is it that you want to do? Because if you know what you want, that play an important role of getting the right people on board, identifying the right and applicable data for your problem and the learning algorithm as part of it as well. And the question you need to ask yourself, whether you actually need machine learning model to fix your problem, because sometimes you don't really need an AI to fix that problem. You know, right. you know, a very simple piece of code can help you with that. And it's, and the cost as well. You should be prepared for that cost.
Right.
Unless or otherwise, you just use a third-party model to do the work for you. But again, how certain you are about that model.
Yeah,
because then you're the one that needs your stake in your reputation or your exactly. business or whatever on someone else's model, someone else is doing that 80% of data cleaning and being able to explain to you, yeah, you can be confident in this because that's a big risk, isn't
and,
it? That's
right.
taking
the major risk that you know I read is that 80-90% of machine learning projects fail to accomplish their objective. You know, how do you think they can reduce that percentage? Like you touched on some of them. Problem identification, making sure ML is really used for it. What about the human capital aspect? Like, you know,
of course, that play an important role because domain expertise play an important role in this equation. Mm. You know, if you let's say you want to build an application to identify fraud in an insurance company, you need to get the right expertise around the table to identify the relevant attributes that define that data set. You know, and we are right. talking about the characteristic features that define that problem. You know, you want to bring, someone who actually knows about that problem.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we're choosing wrong data. And once you have wrong data, you have wrong output. Yeah. Or irrelevant, yeah. I should say.
Yeah. I think that's a warning to us, like techie types, you know, who you just want to get into building the model right away. And then you forget about, okay, well, you know, this needs to solve a real world problem. Mm. And there are people who are going to know about the real world problem or the data that you need or what the data that has been provided means that
and the
are going to be essential, right?
Yeah, GDPR play an important role there as well. You know, whether this model is based on genuine data set.
Mm.
Have you thought about the privacy and GDPR part of it as well?
Right.
Because, you know, you don't want to end up having a model that is based on bogus data.
So, Ed, you said a quite stunning figure there, like 80-90% or something of these projects pretty much fail to deliver.
Pretty crazy, right?
If you're an investor in a startup, new venture that's doing something AI, very cool.
Yeah.
What would you be looking for to try and improve your odds?
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, this 80-90% failure rate, I'd say is higher than, and I worked as a data scientist in the tax authority in Norway. You know, so I saw firsthand how objectives that are set out early on are not achieved oftentimes because of exactly the kinds of problems and shortcomings in the areas that Alan said. Problem definition, ensuring that it's machine learning that can add value and not other things because it's a very costly endeavor to build models, to retrain them, keep them up to date, make sure they don't fall foul of a host of issues that can happen, technically speaking, leakage, illegal use of data that could shut down a project, et cetera. But so if you compare machine learning models with other tools and systems that companies would implement, the failure rate is higher. Now, when it comes to investors, we know the right kinds of investors that are able to deal with high failure rates are technical, risk capital or venture capitalists or some private equity firms. And they're well suited to do this. Now, they have to then bear in mind that there is going to be even higher failure rates in machine learning projects. Usually what gets to be important with any kind of investment in a startup is, well, you know that most startups are going to fail. So look for a value proposition that's at least, say, 10 times higher than the value proposition that the status quo that exists.
So the few that deliver have to deliver much more.
That's right. And I think that 10x, you know, Peter Thiel, I think, talks about 10x better value. That has to be higher for AI projects, I think, for an investor to be able to justify, you know, putting down the money for projects that are going to have higher failure rates. The hope is that as the machine learning and AI science is not just a hype, that within that more and more so people are understanding how to develop these models. There's data scientist talents that have experience, and the hope is that that failure rate will go down mm-hmm. over time. But surely we are in what I think DeepMind's former CEO, called peak hype of AI. And so we stand there now, and there's going to be a lot of failures. There's going to be a lot of, you know, busts within the area and the sector, and probably a lot of disappointment down the line as well.
I think for me, if you understand the process of building AI projects, and if you're okay with the risks, then that's fine. Mm-hmm. So awareness and education play an important role, in my opinion, to, you know, before you start anything, you know, obviously the business value behind it, you know, how is this going to help me to simplify my daily work? Is it going to, if it produces wrong predictions, you know, every now and often, then doesn't really help me that much.
No.
Like in detection, fraud detection, transaction detections, you know, they could be really handy.
Yeah, we've been quite negative, and we've looked a lot at the challenges and it's all failure and it's all so hard, We should look at some of the upsides. So, where are the upsides? Where are the real big gains potentially now or in the future as we develop more stuff? If you were an investor, Alan, where would you invest?
That's an interesting question, because I wouldn't invest in artificial intelligence, to be honest with you. Okay. I would invest in quantum computing. Mm-hmm. I think this is going to be the future. If you combine quantum computing with artificial intelligence, then this is going to be the future. This is where we need to be worried about our jobs, not now.
Okay, well, that's really interesting, because we hear a lot about this. Oh, AI is going to, you know,
ruin all our jobs. AI has been around for nearly 10, 15 years, roughly. And we haven't seen anyone, you know, I don't know if anyone lost their jobs because of AI, you know. Mm-hmm.
But their jobs have just changed maybe, and they've become able to take less of the grunt work and more of the interesting work.
That's true.
Yeah. But with quantum computing,
this is there's more. Yeah. This is, now we have data, we have learning algorithm, but we don't have the capacity or the computing power yet. With quantum computing, if we combine all of these three together, then we have a super intelligent application to do whatever we can think of.
And I think, let me probe Alan on, you know, quantum computing's ability to fast track AI's potential. Like, why is that so?
So think about combining multiple supercomputers together. Mm-hmm. You know, the power that you get out of that. This is, you know, in a simplest format, the simplest definition, that's quantum computing.
Because I think we're talking of orders of magnitude improvements in computational power that probably run into the 100,000 times.
Yeah.
You know, and we talked about earlier about how a lot of these models that have come out. So I think, like, take GPT-4. There's papers that now have shown that the accuracy of the model has gone down, that it's getting less and less reliable. Now, myriad speculations as to why that is, but that speaks to the importance of that training and retraining, right? And so the idea with quantum computing is that the humongous cost of those would come down. Is that right? Is that what you're thinking about?
Yes, the computing power is going to be much more higher than what we have now. As I said, if you combine, you know, multiple supercomputers together in a small device, this is the kind of capacity we're talking about.
And when you say small device, do you mean small device as in my computer and my laptop or whatever?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, well, that will be.
But we're talking about 10, 15, maybe 20 years from now. We're not there yet.
Right.
If you're lucky.
or unlucky, depending on how you look at it and who, what kind of job you've got at the moment.
To go full circle on your question, I think immediately before these 10, 15 years, and I agree that a lot more investment money should go in quantum computing, and probably not just by, you know, the major IBMs and the Googles, potentially more state actors as well. But I find that during this time, it's, you know, you can get great improvements in healthcare, mm-hmm. in the healthcare sector. You know, still disease detection could, you know, machine learning's already done quite a lot, you know, on disease detection there. But you talked about value to humanity. I think the value to humanity is going to be very high in the healthcare sector of using AI models and making them better. And then maybe you're able to detect lung cancer better.
Yeah, but this is all good and perfect if we use it as a tool.
Right,
but
exactly.
But the moment we use that as a, you know, replacement of a medical doctor, this is where things become a bit...
Absolutely.
Problematic, in my opinion.
And so that's where the idea should be that decision-making shouldn't easily be replaced. This should just be a tool that, for example, ascribes a higher probability so that a doctor, a surgeon could actually look at this at a case, you know, earlier to prevent detection of something like lung cancer earlier on. Right?
So we're still using a lot of human judgment, intuition...
I think it's important to use
making sense of things.
Absolutely.
So I don't remember you and I, we had a conversation a little while ago about this when we were first planning the podcast.
Right.
And you had a lovely quote. You said, studying AI had taught me how intelligent humans are.
Right.
Do you want to just explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. It's incredible what humans are capable of. And the, you know, deep learning was born out of an attempt to study the human mind and how, you know, the human mind makes connections, neural connections. The way in which we interpret things are beyond what supercomputers are able to do. And if you think of it, each one of us has the supercomputer up in our head. Mm-hmm. It takes OpenAI billions and billions of dollars and humongous supercomputers to try to get to an near equivalent level of linguistic comprehension.
Mm-hmm.
And linguistic comprehension is a very small part of what we do. So I think what Alan talked about there with a combination of quantum computing, with artificial intelligence, and with robotics, and the combination of these being really the holy grail of where AI could actually start replacing some of our human tasks meaningfully, I think his point there has to do with the fact that we all do all of these in our brain, right? Our speed of analysis is very high.
Mm.
We retrain based on behavioral data, behavioral changes we see.
Yeah, we respond to certain actions. And this is what imagine if we mimic that behavior in a robot.
Mm.
And that is the beginning of a new era in my opinion.
Yeah, so that
absolutely.
And that beginning is still 10, 15 years away. You think
it
requires that combination that you were talking about of AI
research
and
phase
quantum.
At the moment.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, and I think it's the combination of those that we as humans do, right? It's our motor skills are attached to our intelligence and that central thinking we have. So really, real human intelligence is really years away from. To emulate it is years away from where artificial intelligence is now. Currently at general artificial intelligence is the goal, supposedly, mm-hmm. which could then rival potentially humans. But, you know, AI can only be better than humans in certain niches. It's very limited.
I think what we have to remember, any AI applications that we have nowadays, they're all intelligent in a context of the data we provide.
Okay. Yeah.
So if you take ChatGPT as an example, it's intelligent based on what kind of data was used to train that model. While human intelligence is completely different because we have opinions, we read, we respond to certain problems. We don't see that. So it is intelligent, but it's not human intelligence.
It hasn't got a judgment on the data that comes in. It still relies on us to say that's good data, that's bad
data,
that needs cleaning, that doesn't need cleaning.
Yeah. Case in point, that feedback you mentioned, the biggest advance of ChatGPT was human in the loop, you know, putting human beings that were evaluating what the machine was coming and scoring it constantly and constantly.
Which, again, you know, there is a privacy issue in relation to that, because, you know, the more we talk to an application like this, the more we expose our behavior into an unknown territory, really.
That's absolutely fascinating. I'm not sure whether to be excited or terrified.
Not terrified. I think we're both not in terrified. The camp of, you know, this is to be complementary for human beings.
Yeah.
And I don't think fear-mongering is useful.
No, and I think we need to understand the consequences of these things that we do.
Right.
And we need to study them. We need to understand the consequences, basically.
That's so interesting. Thank you for telling me not to be terrified. Thank you for shedding a little light on some of the challenges and things that we need to be thinking about. It's been a fascinating conversation. Ed, Alan, thank you so much.
This is a BI production. Listen to more podcasts. Go to bi.no/podcasts.